Calendar.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Loken, Judge Connolly, Judge Smith, the Honorable Michelle A. Loken presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals for this Zoom session on May 25th, 2022. We are ready for arguments this morning. I'd ask that each of the attorneys state their names before each leg of their argument so we have a record of who is speaking for our audio recording. You'll each have 15 minutes for argument and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, we are ready to hear from counsel for appellant attorney in the first case in the matter of the civil commitment of Eric Matthews Flanders. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is James Conway. I appear on behalf of the appellant Eric Flanders. This is a case about a patient who is so profoundly disabled that his continuing detention in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program is akin to locking a six-year-old child with communication disabilities and post-traumatic stress disorder in a cage and expecting them to progress through what is to him a mysterious and scary group treatment model that he is wholly unable to participate in or even understand. This case arises out of a first stage or a first phase hearing on Mr. Flanders' request for a reduction in custody from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Mr. Flanders is 44 years old now. Since his 18th birthday, he has been under guardianship based on court orders from the state of Minnesota, and he retains that legal guardian today. In the course of this proceeding, Dr. Doherty, the court-appointed examiner, supported a provisional discharge. He outlined in his report and in his testimony that the type of placement that Mr. Flanders needs, which might include an adult foster care type placement in light of his disabilities, would be appropriate in light of the electronic and physical safety measures and external controls that might be available on a provisional discharge status. During the course of the trial, MSOP staff came and testified that in fact, just those types of features are available on a provisional discharge when the plan is implemented by the commissioner and MSOP and its staff. Indeed, they have the power through vendor contracts and their ability to craft particular placements to find adult foster homes and limited staff treatment programs to restrict parties on house arrest, to use GPS monitoring and other physical and electronic surveillance measures to monitor patients in the community. Dr. Doherty also testified that Mr. Flanders derives no benefit from the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. He is wholly without the ability to progress through its program because he intellectually cannot understand what is being presented to him or plan for his care. The court orders out of his guardianship case made clear that he is an incapacitated person that is incapable of planning medical decisions for himself, yet the Minnesota Sex Offender Program's treatment model requires that patients understand their treatment needs and work in a progressive way to work on those needs themselves. Because of Mr. Flanders' intellectual disabilities, he simply can't understand what's happening.
Counsel? Quick question. When did he go under guardianship? Age 16?
Age 18, Your Honor. 18. Immediately following his 18th birthday.
18th birthday. And how long has he been at MSOP?
Slightly more than 15 years now.
And can I ask, how did you become involved? How did we go for 15 years in a program where we have experts saying this program can't treat him?
I was not Mr. Flanders' trial attorney, nor was anyone at my firm. He had a different attorney that got into some trouble with an ethical matter, and Mr. Flanders at that time sought a replacement counsel, and then I became his attorney.
Okay, thank you.
To outline my arguments that are the reasons why the court should remand this case and reverse and remand this case, are twofold. The first is that Mr. Flanders' presentation satisfies the statutory requirements for making out a prima facie case for provisional discharge under Minnesota Statute 260D.30.
How so? Could you address each prong? Are the factors?
Yes, Your Honor. The factors under that statute that the court considers are whether the course of treatment and present mental state of the patient indicate that there is no longer a need for treatment in their current treatment setting. And the second prong deals with public safety and indicates that whether or not a provisional discharge is possible while providing a reasonable degree of protection to the public. The second argument is regarding constitutional standards.
Okay, let's go to the first factor that you just set forth. I mean, do you agree that he still needs sex offender treatment?
Dr. Doherty's testimony was that Mr. Flanders is so intellectually disabled that while he may essentially benefit in a general sense from attending sex offender treatment, he really is wholly unable to progress, particularly in the group treatment model that is provided by MSOP. He indicated that a one-on-one treatment methodology would be much more appropriate given his intellectual abilities.
So your argument is not that he no longer needs sex offender treatment. It's that he needs a form of sex offender treatment that's not available to him at MSOP?
That's partially correct, Jenner.
Okay. Did MSOP say they're able or willing to provide individual treatment for him?
No one from Minnesota Sex Offender Program testifies that they were capable of meeting his treatment needs at this first phase hearing. He has been in essentially the special needs track of treatment programming for the duration of his 15 years. And Dr. Doherty's testimony was during that entire period of time, he has made no progress.
Right. I think now, and it's my understanding of the law in this area that the commitment appeal panel cannot get into the topic of adequacy of treatment. And it seems to me a lot of what you're arguing is that he's not being provided the treatment he needs at MSOP. In other words, the treatment is not adequate. How is the panel allowed to reach that? I know that the judges noted their limited jurisdiction and encourage MSOP to make some changes for this person.
I believe the court is empowered and the panel is required to make that determination. This case is distinct from the kinds of arguments that were outlined in the Poole case. The Poole case involved a former medical doctor that essentially voluntarily disenrolled from treatment. And he made an argument that essentially treating sex offenders in general is so challenging that it results in essentially MSOP being a form of preventative detention. That's not the argument that's being advanced here. This is a singular type of focus as it relates to Mr. Flanders specifically.
Okay. Let me stop you there, because I understand that, but what I'm struggling with is this. The first factor that we consider when a person or patient makes a request for provisional discharge is whether or not they still need treatment in the current setting. And it sounds like there's evidence in the record that he still needs treatment in a secure facility, but that he needs one-on-one treatment and it should be in a group home where there's electronic monitoring, locks on the doors, bars on the windows. I mean, it sounds a whole lot like MSOP, except fewer people and individual treatment. And what you're arguing is his intellectual needs are so extreme that he's incapable of doing the program at MSOP or benefiting from the program. That to me sounds like more of a due process argument than a provisional discharge argument. And as I understand the case law, the appeals panel can consider a due process argument, but only in the context of a request for discharge. And the request for discharge was waived and not litigated below. So what do we do with that?
Okay, the court, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but you've asked sort of multiple questions in one. I'll try to answer them in turn. So the first question is, does he have a need for treatment in his current treatment setting? The concept of a need for treatment implies that he would have a benefit from eating. Like I have a need to eat food to sustain my life. If someone fed me grass, I would eventually die, though they were technically giving me something to eat. Here, they're technically providing him a treatment modality, but he derives no benefit from it. So he has no need to be treated in that group treatment model. The second question was around this amenability to treatment issue. The court, Your Honor, Judge Larkin, you used the term a secure treatment setting. that is a term of art here. And in fact, outpatient treatment in the community would not be a secure treatment setting within the context of this statute. And Dr. Doherty's testimony was that he needs outpatient treatment with a residential treatment site akin to, for example, an adult foster care type of arrangement. Does that answer Your Honor's questions?
All right, yes. How about the due process issue?
Thank you, judges. Yes, and Your Honor, Judge Larkin asked a question about a waiver of the discharge issue. On the record, a request was indicated that he was not pursuing a statutory discharge. There is a difference between the constitutional arguments, which were still advanced, and requesting a statutory discharge, which would require proof that he is both no longer dangerous and no longer in need of treatment.
Right. Got it. So you were saying we're not going to pursue statutory discharge, but we're making a due process argument, and the state weigh in on this. But the case law does seem to say that CAP can consider due process, and in fact did consider the due process argument and rejected it. If this court were to conclude that a prima facie case has been made, is it a prima facie case both as to provisional discharge and the constitutional issues? In other words, on remand, would further information be presented regarding sort of the adequacy of treatment and whether or not there's a constitutional violation because MSOC can't meet his needs?
Yes, at a second stage hearing, there would be a much fuller record, including presentation from the commissioner's office, where they would bear the burden of proof at a heightened standard to demonstrate that he is not capable of being treated. I think it would be a particularly acute set of facts about if you've had 15 years MSOP to treat him and he's made no progress, how
What's
is it possible
on?
That you think yeah. he can now?
So at least that would turn the tables. It would be up to MSOP to come in and establish what it is they can offer him so he could progress and to show that, you know, some reason why he's not progressing other than his intellectual limitations, which he can't control.
Correct.
So the second phase hearing would perhaps do what the panel wanted, which was force MSOP to take a hard look at this and figure out what they can do for him.
Correct.
All right. And I'll ask the state, of course, to address those thoughts in its time.
In terms of the constitutional arguments, the cases in Call, Blodgett, Poole, and Fugleseth have a line of decisions that indicate that it's required to maintain from a due process standpoint that the patient requires ongoing inpatient care and treatment in a secure environment. In this particular instance, the testimony below was that he does not need inpatient care. He should be treated in the outpatient type environment. That would, and the way that the due process standard works is it's either or. Either they do not any longer have a mental illness, or they no longer need inpatient care. And if either of those is true, they're entitled to a constitutional discharge.
Now, my recollection of your brief is you didn't seem to argue both. Your brief seemed to argue that he no longer has the type of mental illness that qualifies him for commitment, as opposed to he's not getting the care he needs.
No, it very much did argue both, Your Honor. I argued that both he no longer had the type of mental illness that would justify commitment. The testimony below was that he may in the past have had a diagnosis of exhibitionist disorder, but that's only by history now. And the testimony from the examiner was his exposing behavior is likely a symptomology associated with his mental, his intellectual disabilities or communication disabilities. Mm-hmm. As it regards the other part of it, that he no longer needs inpatient treatment, there was significant discussion in the brief about what MSOP is capable of providing on provisional discharge. And Dr. Doherty's testimony that both in his report where he was outlining, if these kinds of things were available, that's what I'm thinking of. And then MSOP testified first at the hearing below, identified the very things that Dr. Doherty was contemplating. And then Dr. Doherty testified after that saying, yes, what that guy just said from MSOP, that's exactly what I want. This is very similar to the Crop case where a petitioner sought a discharge to a as yet undetermined treatment setting, testimony was provided that the commissioner, through the executive director of MSOP, would be able to establish a treatment site, and that granting a provisional discharge in that circumstance was appropriate.
Mr. Conway, one of the points that respondent points on in their brief is that she says none of the witnesses testified that the terms and conditions contained in Exhibit 101, the actual provisional discharge plan at issue, satisfied the statutory requirements. Could you respond to that, please?
I will. I only have about 15 seconds, so I will attempt to do that.
You could have a little extra time.
So as I was just indicating, the testimony below was he would, as a plan, comply with the Exhibit 101, which is the boilerplate provisional discharge provisions offered by MSOP. In testimony, the reintegration director testified that his department, once a CAP order is made for provisional discharge, actually goes and implements, for example, housing requirements, security requirements, the GPS monitoring for the patient. And then Dr. Doherty testified, yes, in what I've indicated in my report that was more fully expressed by the MSOP staff was in fact what I was contemplating. And that is the type of treatment and environment that would be sufficient to both meet Mr. Flanders' treatment needs as well as reasonably protect the public.
I guess, you know, what I got from that answer was he didn't have a plan, but he said he'd do whatever he was required to do. And Dr. Doherty said, when these things were discussed about the bracelet and all this other stuff, yeah, that might work or that should work. You know, that's different from, well, here's my plan. I'm going to be at the group home. I'm going to have a bracelet from 8 to 10. I've arranged for an individual psychiatrist to give me individualized treatment. You know, the group home is not near a school, et cetera, et cetera. You know, was any of that testimony presented on behalf of your client as in, here's my plan?
Mr. Flanders intellectually is incapable of making a plan. That's why his plan as presented at the SRB and the CAP was comply with a treatment program that meets the standards that MSOP has in every case, where, and it's essentially a fungible kind of construct where the executive director implements a residential placement, a treatment program, a security model, all to meet the individualized treatment needs of the patient. And that was his plan. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have rebuttal time. We'll now hear from counsel for the state. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Monal Patel appearing on behalf of the commissioner.
You may proceed.
Appellant failed to make a prima facie showing with competent evidence that he is entitled to provisional discharge, and appellant's constitutional arguments lack merit. Appellant presented no competent evidence that the terms and conditions of the standard MSOP provisional discharge plan, the only plan that was before the Special Review Board, the SRB, met the statutory criteria for provisional discharge. A person civilly committed as a sexually dangerous person, SDP, shall not be provisionally discharged unless they meet the criteria under Minnesota Statute 253D.30. The factors to be considered are, one, whether the committed person's course of treatment and present mental status indicate there is no longer a need for treatment and supervision in the committed person's current treatment setting. On this respect, the panel correctly found no evidence that appellant's needs could be met under the provisional discharge plan he presented to the SRB. Dr. Doherty did not support provisional discharge on terms and conditions in appellant's provisional discharge plan. The record is clear that appellant still has a diagnosis of a variety of psychological and sexual disorders, such as other specified paraphilic disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and antisocial personality disorder.
Patel, do you agree with Mr. Conway that whatever they're doing now at MSOP does not work for his client?
I do not agree, Your Honor. Mr. Flanders is in the alternative program at MSOP. He is encouraged to participate in the program. Dr. Doherty is certainly entitled to his opinion. But the case law is clear that commitment can continue as long as continuing treatment bears reasonable relation to the reason the individual is committed. And there's been no doubt in the record that Mr. Flanders continues to show high actuarial scores and disorders tied to his offending.
But I mean, I guess, if he has an IQ, here I'm paraphrasing, of 50, whatever this group therapy is, doesn't work for him. I mean, is that a fair statement, or am I wrong on that too, Ms. Patel?
I believe that would be an incorrect characterization of the treatment that Mr. Flanders is receiving at MSOP. And to further note, the narrow question in front of the court is related to sort of the purpose of provisional discharge. The purpose of provisional discharge is to transition the client into society and not to create a custom treatment setting like the one that Mr. Flanders is currently intimating. The argument that Mr. Flanders is not getting the correct treatment, well, that goes towards to the fact that case law has stated that the panel and the court do not get involved in treatment decisions at MSOP.
Counsel, so on that note, I'd like to hear on the constitutional issue, to say, well, the facility bears some reasonable relation to treatment. Okay, well, yes, he's got a sexual diagnosis. He needs sex offender treatment. His actuarial scores are high, and MSOP is a secure treatment program. So yes, there's a relation. But as Judge Connolly asked, what do we do if this particular person is not capable due to a disability of benefiting from the treatment program? Doesn't that raise a concern? And I guess the second question is, okay, if adequacy of treatment can't be addressed in the context of provisional discharge, can it be addressed in the context of due process before the commitment appeal panel? And if not there, under the Supreme Court's Lonergan case, could he not bring a motion under Rule 60 for relief from judgment since he can't get provisional discharge? I mean, how does one take a look at, you know, he's been there 15 years. It seems that there weren't glowing reports about the ability of MSOP to treat him. After 15 years, how does a patient come to the court and say, I need more than they're giving me? Is it Rule 60?
Your Honor, I believe that is properly accounted for in the SRB and panel process. In front of the SRB process, Mr. Flanders is permitted and, in fact, entitled to counsel to consult with, access records, prepare throughout any proceedings, and present any provisional discharge plan with terms and conditions that may be considered.
Okay, that's not what I'm asking. Counsel, what I'm asking is, if a patient wants to make an adequacy of treatment argument, if a patient wants a hearing where he or she can present evidence that due to their disability, which is beyond their control, they are incapable of benefiting from the treatment offered at MSOP and they need a different form of treatment, and MSOP either needs to provide it or we need to perhaps let him go. How does a person make that argument? Because it's not through provisional discharge before the CAP, because as you've said, CAP doesn't get into adequacy of treatment. So how does one raise an adequacy of treatment argument when there is an argument to be made?
Your Honor, if I'm understanding the question correctly, the appellant could have presented testimony and as it relates to the constitutional question of whether his continued commitment bears some reasonable relation to the purpose for which appellant was originally committed under Call v. Gomez. And here, the appellant continues to suffer from a variety of disorders related to his sexual offending. And in Critch, there was a finding by the Minnesota Court of Appeals holding a personality disorder is sufficient for commitment under the MCTCA.
Counsel, I'm afraid you're not understanding my question. I'm going to try to make it as simple as possible. How and where does a committed patient get before a court and make the argument that the treatment being provided is not adequate? Is the state's position they don't get to do that ever?
No, Your Honor, that is not the state's position.
Okay. So then how does a patient do that?
The patient could present a provisional discharge or discharge plan to the SRB.
Counsel, the state is telling us, and case law tells us, that the CAP panel can't evaluate adequacy of treatment. So to say the SRB board, you go that route, and then you end up before the CAP panel, and the CAP panel can't consider the issue. That's why I'm not understanding the answer. Can you help me understand how going through the SRB, then to the CAP panel, gets review of the adequacy of treatment?
Well, Your Honor,
Would it be, Ms. Patel, let me see if I can help you out. Would it be the Rule 60? I mean, is that the way to go? You know, to say, okay, whatever they're doing doesn't work for me, and that's got to change. And maybe, okay, it's not the provisional discharge route because, you know, that's a whole other stuff. And, you know, that kind of suggests things are going well and now I can go with just a little less monitoring. But maybe it's the Rule 60 approach, because it seems at that point it's like, well, there's got to be some review for this guy to say whatever you're doing doesn't work. And, you know, that's just, it's America. So wouldn't it be the Rule 60, don't you think?
That could be the case, Your Honor. I guess I am not.
Well, that's fine. I'm not really up on that as well, but trying to just, you know, help you out there.
Boy.
If I may continue.
I'll help you out a little bit too. I'm looking at the Lonergan opinion from the Minnesota Supreme Court, which says the Commitment Act does not provide any procedures for a patient indeterminately committed as an SDP or SPP to raise non-transfer, non-discharge claims such as ineffective assistance of counsel and lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Thus, unlike when a patient brings a Rule 60-02 motion seeking a transfer or discharge, the rule does not distinctly conflict with the Commitment Act when a patient committed as an SDP or SPP brings a Rule 60 motion based on a non-transfer, non-discharge claim. So wouldn't a claim that a patient is not being provided adequate treatment potentially be raised under Rule 60 on the theory that for any other reason justify relief from the operation of the judgment?
Sure, Your Honor. Based on that opinion, that could be the case. And that is not within the bounds of the current proceeding before the panel and currently on.
Do you think it gets within the bounds given the constitutional issue? And I don't know the answer to this. I'm trying to sort through it because we've got case law that says the CAP panel has to look at due process claims. So I guess the response from appellant is, there is discharge, as in statutory discharge. Someone comes forward and meets the standards to show that they no longer need to be committed and locked up. Then there's discharge in terms of a constitutional argument, due process violation. You can't continue this commitment because it would violate my due process rights. Does the CAP panel have the ability to consider the latter?
Which was the latter, Your Honor?
The due process violation. In other words, could this court conclude you know what? He doesn't meet the standard for provisional discharge, just on the face of the statute. However, he's raised this argument that he's not getting the treatment he needs and there's a due process violation. Now, I know that the CAP panel said there's no due process violation. He's a sex offender, needs sex offender treatment. This is MSOP, he gets it. Could we remand for a second phase hearing on his due process argument?
Your Honor, it would be the commissioner's position that a part two hearing would be essentially rendered meaningless as a matter of law, because the terms that Dr. Doherty presented were not in any provisional discharge plan that was before the panel. There was no evidence that
all right, so let's say in my hypothetical, he loses on provisional discharge. He hasn't made a prima facie case. Again, just a hypothetical. So now we turn to his due process argument, which is, as a matter of due process, my commitment should be over, because he would be defining, you know, treatment related to the reason for commitment as treatment that would actually work, that actually addresses his needs given his current disability. Is that an issue that's properly before the CAP?
No, Your Honor, because the issue was not, there was no prima facie evidence that as a constitutional matter, the appellant is entitled to discharge in this case. And if this matter were-
He's been there 15 years. He's got the intellectual capacity of a six-year-old. The independent examiner said, you know, this exposure behavior is likely just due to him trying to get attention and other things. But even if it's sexually motivated, I mean, I don't see any findings in the CAP order that says, yeah, they can treat him. They've got one-on-one. They can work with somebody at this intellectual level. Instead, the panel ends its order by saying, this panel has limited jurisdiction and can only grant relief based upon specific criteria. The panel cannot direct or evaluate the effectiveness of treatment. However, it strongly encourages MSOC to reevaluate petitioner's needs and make all necessary accommodations for him. I mean, I can read between those lines. They don't think MSOP's doing a great job after 15 years. And no fault to MSOP. I mean, a one size fits all program may not work for somebody with intellectual disabilities this significant.
Well, Your Honor, I just like to note that there, Mr. Flanders is intellectually disabled, and that is in the record. There's many individuals who successfully make the transition through the program. The program that Mr. Flanders is currently in is geared towards individuals who have intellectual disabilities. There has been some evidence in the past that Mr. Flanders has been willing to engage in treatment. And if Mr. Conway or an attorney wishes to present a provisional discharge or discharge plan that could meet the statutory criteria, he's certainly able to do so. But in this case, the plan that was before the SRB is not sufficient to meet the criteria. And there is recourse available under similar circumstances. Mr. Flanders could wait 6 months after this proceeding concludes and all of his appeal rights have been have passed, and he could petition the SRB with a provisional discharge plan that does comport with what Dr. Doherty intimated potentially. And you know, the Dr. Doherty's testimony included terms that just are simply not in front of the panel for consideration, and the panel correctly found that appellant was not entitled to provisional discharge based upon the statutory and constitutional grounds.
Thank you. Rebuttal argument?
Thank you, Your Honors. I think picking up on this discussion about the Lonergan decision, there seems to be some degree of conflict between the Court of Appeals decisions and the Minnesota Supreme Court's decisions. And frankly, there really hasn't been a case that's precisely like this one that has been heard by any appellate court in the state, at least to the extent of my research.
What's the conflict between the Court of Appeals decision and the Supreme Court decision?
So the Lonergan case, which is a 2012 decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court, indicated that there was this sort of narrow scope of questions that could be argued in a Rule 60 manner, like ineffective assistance of counsel. Lonergan himself was arguing that he could not be treated or wasn't receiving treatment at MSOP, and the court determined, yes, that is a kind of thing that could be determined in a Rule 60 manner. But then in 2020, the Court of Appeals issued the Opiaca decision, and I believe there may be prior decisions to that as well, outlining that a due process argument is one that the panel must consider. So now there are sets of potentially conflicting case law about whether you can pursue it in Rule 60 or you would be required to pursue it in front of the cap. One of the issues in a Rule 60 case would be that you'd have to exhaust your remedies elsewhere before you brought the Rule 60 motion. Okay. So even if it is true that it's possible for a person in Mr. Flanders' position to argue a Rule 60 motion, he would still nonetheless be required to bring this all the way, you know, potentially requesting review here. And then if the court denied a remand, a reversal and remand, also petition the Minnesota Supreme Court before he ever brought the Rule 60 motion.
Yes, counsel, if I may ask, and maybe this is evident to everyone but me, is a Section 1983 action for injunctive relief based on due process violation to provide adequate treatment, or in this case, a disability claim for injunctive relief, failure to accommodate a disability, are those unavailable to your client?
They might be available, but similarly, he has to exhaust his other remedies before he seeks like habeas type relief.
I'm talking about not habeas, but Section 1983. And again, you know, I'm receiving wholly inadequate treatment. It's a violation of my due process rights. I'm seeking I want to prove that. I'm seeking injunctive relief to order MSOP to provide me adequate treatment. Or under the disability laws, my intellectual disability is not being accommodated. So under, you know, Minnesota statute, the MHRA. Seek relief there. I mean, I'm wondering why the adequacy is not determinable in a place and with a court that has jurisdiction. We don't have to find it like some way to sneak it in somewhere before the SRB or the cap in this like odd sort of, you know, square peg round hole problem, but instead directly a district court action that challenges the adequacy and the constitutionality of what's happening there or the disability discrimination.
I think that's been attempted a number of times, and it seems to be a rather consistent pattern that the appellate courts tend to reject those arguments and say your remedy is to pursue relief under the Commitment Act, not through some collateral attack.
A collateral attack on the adequacy of the treatment? I mean, that might be true. I'm asking this question, and maybe there is case law that says no, there's some like barrier to that, like sort of structural barrier in the law, but and you're telling me, I guess, those cases have been rejected for some reason?
There was rather significant litigation in the federal courts in the Carstens case. Part of the class of individuals in that case were intellectually disabled individuals. I don't know if any of them had an acute set of disabilities as extreme as my client. The analogy below was that he is as disabled intellectually as Albert Einstein was as a genius. And he is as unique in the population in that way as Albert Einstein might have been in the scope of genius. So I think there was some challenge to that, but ultimately the Eighth Circuit rejected it. And some of those claims failed, essentially saying your remedy is within the statute. It's not within a 1983 argument or a collateral attack for like a habeas petition.
Oh my gosh. Could you answer to which case of the Court of Appeals says CAP has to consider due process argument?
The Opiaca case, I know for certain does. The Opiaca case is, however, a commitment action about mentally ill and dangerous. There's a significant degree of overlap in the law that applies from a constitutional basis in these two realms.
But, okay, do we have an SPP case in which this court has said CAP has to consider due process argument?
I don't want to misstate what the Blodgett case says, But my belief is that the Blodgett case contained a set of law about this issue as well, which was a sex offender commitment case. Okay.
Well, has anyone, you know, you're saying Lonergan seems to say or suggest you could raise adequacy of treatment in a Rule 60.02 motion. Has anyone attempted to do that in the state courts? And what was the outcome?
I don't know specifically if anyone has attempted it in state court, but if they attempted and failed in state court and it went to an appellate court of this state, there appears to be no decision of an appellate court on that issue.
Okay. All right. Well, everyone's time is up. We thank you for your arguments. You will have a decision from the court within the time required by statute. Thank you again for the arguments and briefing.